From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we'll meet the royalty of the insect world, monarch butterflies.
Trust me, no greater species makes people go cuckoo del fuego than the monarch. It hits people like they're blind.
And we'll check out a San Francisco group that's cuckoo del fuego for all sorts of critters.
10 different spider species, 3 different bumblebees, lots of different beetles, fence lizards, birds of prey, songbirds.
Then we'll join scientists trying to save a once common species of California frog.
What we're doing is basically inoculating these frogs just like you would get a vaccination shot.
Living with the creatures among us, today on Cross Currents. Today's show is all about cohabitation. Now, you may think of that in terms of people, but if you expand the definition, you can include the plants and animals we share space with, and insects, like the monarch butterfly. Monarchs are the only butterfly we know of that make a two-way migration like birds do. Riding currents of air, they can travel up to 250 miles in one day. In the winter, they fly from as far north as Canada to the warm tree canopies in Mexico. Many stay along the California coast, and one of their favorite spots is the tiny town of Pacific Grove near Monterey. But this annual migration could soon come to a halt. That's because monarchs are in trouble. Over the past few decades, their numbers have declined so much, it would be like losing every living person in the United States except the ones living in Texas. So what's causing this decimation? And what does the disappearance of the monarchs mean for the rest of us? KALW's Marlo McKenzie has the story.
Monarchs need trees. Thick, luscious, full, protective trees. That's their ideal winter resort. California has more than 450 coastal resorts like this, and today I'm in one of the oldest known ones, the Monarch Grove Sanctuary in Pacific Grove. Monarchs check in here around October, and they check out in around March. It's late spring, and longtime sanctuary volunteer Barb Thomas and I are hoping to spot a few of the butterflies.
Look, there's one on the ground. Movie. Wait, are there two?
Well, let's
no
see
way. Are they mating?
Mating.
We're getting some lift here. Okay,
on,
now,
go. Come on, do it.
Right now, the guy, who we can tell is a male by the black dot at the end of his wings, he's trying to lift the female up into the trees, where they'll have a passionate evening of romance. If they do successfully mate, then the male dies. From here, the female will fly to somewhere like Fresno to lay her eggs on a milkweed plant. Throughout the migration, monarchs rely on a healthy habitat to support them, which is why sanctuaries like this one are really important.
This was the bench that was made in memory of Roe Vaquero.
Roe Vaquero is known in Pacific Grove as the Butterfly Lady. She saved the Monarch Grove Sanctuary from development back in the 90s.
If it weren't for her, we wouldn't have this at all, period.
And the thousands of monarchs who stay here every winter would have to find somewhere else to go. Despite efforts by people like Roe Vaquero and Barb Thomas, monarchs are in danger. Right now, U.S. Fish and Wildlife is considering putting them on the endangered species list. That's because the monarch population has declined about 90% in the last 20 years. To find out why, I headed north to San Francisco, just like a monarch might in springtime.
My name's Liam O'Brien. I'm a lepidopterist, which is a fancy schmancy word for the study of butterflies and moths.
If San Francisco has a butterfly guy, Liam O'Brien is him. He's been part of conservation of the green hairstreak butterfly, the endangered Mission Blues on Twin Peaks, and the western tiger swallowtail. He's also spent a lot of time thinking about monarchs and what's killing them off. O'Brien says it's hard to attribute it to just one thing. There's
global warming. With global warming, we're seeing such radical changes in a creature's distribution and movement.
Monarchs use temperature as a gauge to know which way to migrate. If the temperature is off, they might head the wrong way. Then there's
pesticides that are sprayed around farms, killing the endemic milkweed.
And milkweed is the only plant they can lay their eggs on to reproduce. So no milkweed, no monarchs. And no monarchs, then what? Why are they so important? Well, here's the question. Do monarchs pollinate?
Butterflies basically are not pollinators. That is a giant misconception. The pollinators are the stocky little robust guys that are doing the heavy lifting. The bees, the wasps, the flies, and the not-so-pretty cousins of the butterflies, the moths.
But O'Brien says monarchs have an important role in the ecosystem.
80% of all the eggs that a butterfly lays on a plant are eaten. Then, 80% of the 20% of the 80% of the 20%...
You don't need to do any of the math. The point is...
butterflies are, and have always been, a moving smorgasbord for everyone else.
Okay, so I get it. If we lose the butterflies, you're taking away food for wasps, flies, or birds, and the whole food chain gets knocked out of balance. But there's something else about monarchs.
Trust me, no greater species makes people go cuckoo del fuego than the monarch. It hits people like they're blind.
People love monarch butterflies, so scientists say there's a different way to think about them entirely.
I've seen the Mona Lisa in Paris. What good is the Mona Lisa?
That's Lincoln Brower, a research professor of biology at Sweetbriar College on the East Coast.
I mean, really, it's just a painting on a piece of paper, but we revere it. It's part of our culture and part of our tradition. And I think that we need to realize that biological treasures such as the monarch are valuable in their own right.
Liam O'Brien agrees, and he thinks that people's love of the monarchs might mean there's hope for the less adored, but equally endangered bugs out there.
If it begins the conversation of insect conservation, then that's great.
Especially because scientists say the monarch's decline means trouble is ahead for other species. Fortunately, if you're cuckoo del fuego over monarchs, O'Brien says there are things you can do, like planting flowers in your yard, or milkweed if it's native to your area. In San Francisco, I'm Marlo McKenzie for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane. Today, we're considering the struggling species we live with. Now, as you traverse your part of the bay on roads and railways, you may not realize there's another world of pathways used by other creatures, a hidden world of nature corridors connecting one habitat to another. Amber Hasselbring directs Nature in the City. It's a program dedicated to taking care of wild places throughout San Francisco. Her group maintains over a dozen sites that foster life for bees, birds, and even a tiny butterfly called the green hairstreak, which nearly disappeared before people found a way to help. She joined me in studio, and I asked her, what is a nature corridor?
So it's really just about creating safe passageway. Plants or animals can become isolated because of many different factors in the city. It happens to be urbanization. So we started to build small habitat patches to connect the isolated populations of a green hairstreak butterfly.
And so the nature corridors, or this one we're talking about, was really inspired by the decline of this butterfly, the green hairstreak butterfly.
Yeah, this butterfly once flew throughout the whole western part portion of the city. And so it was pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And now it's in the upper rocks, just before you'd get to Twin Peaks, say. So it's really pushed up and back toward its, you know, last existing range in the city.
And so what happened after you built this corridor with those butterflies in mind?
Well, we started planting in 2007. And then in 2008, we saw our first adults, females, in the corridor. So it happened pretty much immediately that the females started to disperse the population from the original habitats and move into these habitats that were intended to connect those populations together.
And how does the connection work?
So the males and females emerge in the springtime, or very early spring, sometimes as early as January. Males emerge first, and they wait for the females to emerge, and then the females emerge from the chrysalis, and they mate immediately. The females are programmed to disperse the population, so they fly about 200 feet away from their original habitat, and they sometimes fly off into the urban abyss. But if they happen to find one of these habitat patches that we've built, they can find suitable habitat to lay their eggs, and then the population can expand.
And just as a kind of devil's advocate question, why does it matter if we have green hairstreak butterflies or not?
Well, Robert Michael Pyle talks about this extinction of experience idea. So as human beings, if we're losing species on the planet, we are not only losing that species, but we're losing our experience with connecting with it. So in urban areas, this can be even more compounded because we're losing more species in urban areas than we are in our wildlands. So having that experience where you're a child and you see this iridescent green butterfly coming down and taking nectar from a flower in front of you, or taking your net and catching it, that is irreplaceable.
And so it's about experience rather than, you know, when I think about, for example, the bees, the colony collapse that's causing a lot of bees to die off, and how, you know, that's made very relevant to my life because I can see all of the kinds of food that wouldn't exist without the bees. And so with some of these other insects like the green hairstreak butterfly, it's not so much tied directly to the food that's going to be on my plate. It's more about...
that's a great question. There's this sense that, you know, with the bees that we can have these biological services, they call it. And so it means, you know, that, you know, we get certain benefits from having direct pollination services and get to eat fruits. But in addition, you know, insects are the food web, the base of the food web, plants and then insects and then birds. So to take out even one species from that can have that big, you know, a lasting effect.
I'm talking with Amber Hasselbring. She's the Executive Director of Nature in the City. What other kinds of species live in the nature corridors here in San Francisco besides the green hairstreak?
So last May, we did a volunteer-run BioBlitz of the corridor with the application called iNaturalist. We found 250-plus different unique species in the corridor in just one day. These were like 10 different spider species, 3 different bumblebees, lots of different beetles, fence lizards, birds of prey, songbirds. So the whole array of life can be seen in these corridors.
And are there many endangered species in San Francisco?
Yeah, to give you some context, there are 36 different plants and animals that are endangered throughout the GGNRA. So that's the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And that's in 3 different counties. And in San Francisco alone, there are 10 different endangered species. And those are everything from the snowy plover, which is a bird that nests on Ocean Beach, to, you know, the I think it's San Francisco Lysingia, which is a plant in the Presidio, and the red-legged frog, which has some very, very small and isolated populations, and also the Mission Blue butterfly, which is flying up on Twin Peaks again due to restoration work there.
How did you get involved? Where's your heart in all of this?
Oh, I have an art background, so I understand sort of complexity and creativity and color and continuing to carry myself as an artist into this, but really devoting all of my work to nature.
I like that idea a lot of making art with creating natural habitats.
Yeah, we just got a chance to do an urban prototyping festival that happened on Market Street. And this is another urban wildlife corridor that's pretty exciting. So Market Street itself looks a little bit like a river canyon ecosystem. And the western tiger swallowtail butterfly uses that. And many other species use that corridor as well to travel. So we're trying to enhance that now as the city is thinking about redesigning. And it has a lot of artistic components as well in that project.
That's amazing. So a butterfly thinks that Market Street is a beautiful river corridor.
River canyon ecosystem. Mm-hmm. With trees lining both sides, and it flies along the canopies of the trees so that it doesn't necessarily come down into our human vision as much. But it's up there.
I love that. And that actually makes me think about the connection with actually the city government. Can you talk a little bit about those connections with the city?
Yeah, absolutely. We can't do this work without partnerships. So we're heavily partnered with the Rec and Park Department Natural Areas Program. We have partnerships with volunteer services like Hands on Bay Area. And we're partnered with the Department of Public Works to even work on this public land and build habitats here. We're also partnered with the San Francisco Department of the Environment. They have a new biodiversity coordinator. And we have a lot of partnerships with the planning department as well.
And I've been thinking a lot about this idea of cohabitation, mm-hmm. because human beings live in San Francisco and we're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we're really kind of expanding as much as we can. And so this idea of these nature corridors seems like a really nice way to find avenues for us to all live together.
The city is really allocating resources toward this thinking. And because San Francisco is a peninsula surrounded by bodies of water with 43 different hilltops and along the Pacific Flyway for bird migration, and in addition has so many different soil types and microclimates, we could be the city of biodiversity.
That's Amber Hasselbring, Executive Director of Nature in the City. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane. In San Francisco, there's a place specifically dedicated to the conservation of animal species. It's the San Francisco Zoo. One of the animals they're trying to protect is the mountain yellow-legged frog. Now, they used to be so abundant in the California mountains, visitors said you could hardly go for a hike around an alpine lake without stepping on them. But now, they're found only in California's most protected areas, and they're facing extinction. KALW's Colin Peden has the story about what's caused the decline and what biologists are doing to help.
I'm in a room stacked with rows of 50-gallon fish tanks, surrounded by gurgling water pumps. But this isn't a fish store. I'm with conservation biologist Jesse Bichelle, in a building way behind the scenes of the SF Zoo. She's giving me the lowdown on the tadpoles' menus.
These guys eat primarily algae, so we give them a couple different options for algae. We give them the algae gel that we make here. We plate that out. Then we also plate a different type of algae for their evening meal.
These fish tanks are a far cry from these tadpoles' natural habitats. Still, they're thriving and are about to become froglets. Yeah, that's the technical term, froglets.
This tank now, we've been having, it's in like metamorph mania in here. Yeah. So even just like 2 weeks ago, we had 55. Now we're down to about 25 in this tank.
They're turning into mountain yellow-legged frogs. It's a species that's native only to the high Sierra Nevada. Imagine ice-cold snowmelt ponds and creeks surrounded by lodgepole pines. So what are they doing here?
Just this summer, we had eggs. We collected eggs, brought them in. They hatched. And this is our last remaining group.
Bichelle is raising these tadpoles from egg to adult. It's part of a huge effort to ensure the species' survival. You see, what was once one of the most common sounds of spring in the High Sierra, their weird buzzing frog call, is now one of the rarest. That's why, for conservation biologists, these tadpoles represent an important investment in the future. One researcher spent years following mountain yellow-legged frog populations. In 2005, he was greeted with a terrible surprise.
As I got to the shore of the lake and I looked around, I started seeing a few here, a dozen there, 100 there. And by the time I walked the shoreline, there were thousands, literally thousands of dead frogs floating around in the water, upside down, bloated on the shoreline, dried up. It was one of the worst sights I've ever seen in my entire life. And unfortunately, it wasn't the last time that I saw that.
That's conservation biologist Vance Vredenburg.
I'm an associate professor at San Francisco State University.
The killer turned out to be a fungus, not the portobello mushroom kind of fungus, but a microscopic disease-causing one.
This fungus is called Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis.
Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis. That's a mouthful, but it's worth knowing, because it's implicated in a huge global epidemic. You can also call it chytrid, or BD. What you need to know is that it causes a massive skin infection. Among other things, this prevents the frogs from breathing through their skin. Most frogs die of cardiac arrest due to the stress of the disease.
Here in California, or throughout Central America and South America, it's wiped out literally hundreds of species. But what's really interesting is that even in those same habitats where these mass epidemics have occurred, there's a few species that survive.
Researchers look to discover what might be causing this resistance. A lot of us have heard of beneficial bacteria by now. They've found that there are actually skin bacteria that protect some of these frogs from infection.
It turns out that they have these bacteria that produce antifungal compounds.
Research confirms that by introducing these bacteria, the species is called J. lividum, you can prevent the frogs from getting the fungal infection in the first place. But while this works in controlled lab experiments, SF Zoo's Jesse Bichelle tells me this species isn't abundant enough in the High Sierras.
You can't just dose the frog once with J. lividum and just expect that it's going to make it. It has to continuously be exposing itself to the environment. If it's not in the environment, it's not going to work.
Oh, man.
So instead, what we're doing is looking at creating an adaptive immune response. So basically inoculating these frogs just like you would get a vaccination shot.
So here at the zoo, the frogs are getting these shots in a program organized by a coalition of researchers.
It's a combination of U.S. Forest Service, Cal Fish and Wildlife, the Tahoe Basin Land Management Group, and then a variety of researchers that are involved.
They're trying to give the mountain yellow-legged frog a boost, a head start, so that they can be released back into the wild and have a better chance against this epidemic.
We had a really successful year this year. I mean, I have over 150 animals that will be released this year and next year.
This is exciting news for Bichelle and all the others involved. But put that in context. That's still just 150 animals being released from a species that used to be incredibly abundant, as Vredenburg recalls.
You walk along the shores of these lakes, and there are so many frogs in the shorelines that as you're walking, it sounds like rain hitting the water. And there can be schools of tadpoles that can be black in the water.
Vredenburg says that this shows how important they've been to the ecosystem in the past.
Because everything that could eat them in the High Sierra Nevada ate them. Everything from brewer's blackbirds and ravens, small mammals, all the way up to bears would actually eat these frogs, both the tadpoles and the adults.
But he's hopeful for the future.
I really do think they're survivors, and they've been able to survive for 5 million years, probably a lot more. They should be able to survive this.
50 years ago, it wouldn't have even occurred to conservationists to raise these frogs from egg to adult because they were so common. Maybe in another 50 years, this will be the case again. For Cross Currents, I'm Colin Peden.
We've got more information about the threatened and endangered species we've talked about in today's show. Go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. Our team includes Leela Day, Jeremy Dalmas, Jack Detch, Audrey Dilling, Rachel Dornhelm, Marcy Fraser, Chris Hoff, Emma Noble, Lizak Shalit, and Stephen Short. Today's show was produced by Marlo McKenzie. It was engineered by Seth Samuel. Line producer was Angela Johnston. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is me, Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll meet the people who deal with the aftermath of police shootings.
The most important to me is like clients or other activists who say, you are the first people who listened to me. You allowed me to stop feeling that I wanted to die. You stopped me from going to kill a cop.
Connection after tragedy. That's tomorrow on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music? It's by soul singer Guapile. Rolling Stone says this Oakland-raised performer mixes sweet soul vocals, jazz, funk, instrumentation, and hip-hop rhythms by underground Bay Area beat masters. Guapile will be very much above ground on Sunday when she performs at the San Francisco Jazz Center. Music starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane. Play around. Tell me if you think that you can get down. 'Cause this is what I'm dying for. I mean, this is what I'm